This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hey, After Buzzers, before we move on to your next topic, we just want to say thanks to our sponsor, Anchor. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. Plus, there are creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Also, Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. Plus, you can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership, and it's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to Anchor FM to get started.
You're tuning in to the online broadcast network, AfterBuzz TV. Over 20 million weekly downloads in over 150 countries and your number one source for after-show entertainment. AfterBuzz TV, the destination for TV superfans, producing aftershows for over 300 of your favorite TV shows, interviewing celebrities and showrunners, and bringing you behind-the-scenes exclusives. All thanks to E! Entertainment's Maria Menounos, producer Kevin Undergaro, and internet leader Akamai. Now, let the buzz begin!
There it is.
Smooth.
Silky.
White man silky. Over bite. Where is it?
There it is.
Got to feel it. Mm.
Welcome to the AfterBuzz TV. No, AfterBuzz TV's True Detective After Show. I'm Joe Braswell. I'm joined for once in his life by Joe Sanfilippo.
It's nice to be here.
I know we have a guest today, which when you come out for the guest.
You do come out for the guest.
I have a month-old baby. I've been sequestered.
Yes, fair enough. Fair enough. How you doing, Joe?
Living the dream. How are you, Joe?
I'm fantastic. I'm also living the dream.
Well, good. We're both dreaming.
Yes.
And we're caught in the middle.
Yeah. Julia. What's happening in this dream?
I'm also joined by the lovely Julia Carey.
Hi, everybody. Nice to be back. And Ben and I had a nice little date last week.
Yeah, it's pretty romantic.
Just the two of us, it was.
Julia, you've been working on your super secret project.
I have been working on my super secret project.
But we won't talk about that because it's super secret.
It is super secret.
But Ben Bateman. How are you, sir?
I'm excited to talk about True Detective. Man,
you were holding it down last week.
It's my favorite episode of the season so far. I've been a fan pretty much the whole season.
It's pretty strong.
Yeah,
it's pretty strong. I got some feelings on that too. But more importantly, I said I'm who I am. But we're also joined by the lovely, the fantastic John Lindstrom.
Woo!
Thank you very much, John.
I don't think anyone's referred to me as lovely.
Lovely.
I like it. I think it's quite fitting.
But I'll take it.
Lovely, you are.
Oh, thank you,
John. If you don't recognize him, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see John, and you may recognize him as the mysterious Jacob McCann. From TV's True Detective, the show that we're doing right now. And if you're not watching on YouTube, then you'll hear his voice because
that's how this works.
And that's all it really takes.
We're going to talk to John a little later on about sort of his. He had the pleasure of working with multiple directors. When I asked him what it was like working with Nick, asked him what it was like working with Justin Lin and Miguel in this last episode. But before that, we want to talk about the episode itself. And those of you who are live streaming, feel free to ask us some questions for John if you guys want to know anything at all, because we'll talk to him about whatever. He's going to tell us everything, including how it ends. So
that's what I do, man.
Yeah. We won't let him out of the room until he does.
The show will not end until he tells us how
we are locked in a room.
Season two ends, since it's already in the can. I want to get some thoughts on this episode. I know yours, I know mine, I know yours, Ben, but let's start with Joe Filippo. Joe, what did you think of this one?
I like this episode a lot.
Good.
I enjoyed it very much, and I thought that I started to get Frank's character more. I felt like he came out in a way this week that I kind of understood him more. I felt like everything kind of worked, it kind of clicked for me a little bit more. And I really liked, Rachel McAdams was Stone Cold Killer.
It's really good.
Or a Stone Cold Fox in that dress.
Ooh! Yeah. And apparently we're done.
That happened. Don't mind that.
We have a live streaming client going at the same time.
Live stream.
We're too live.
To that crew. You, Julia.
My turn. I agree. This is my favorite episode yet of this season. I feel like I got a really great deep insight into who these characters are. I feel like over the last many episodes, we've sort of scratched the surface on these people's pasts and what they've been through and why they're so effed up. But now I feel like we're a little bit more clear on why they are who they are and what their motivations are. The goals were pretty straightforward in this episode. It was a very disturbing episode there at the end, but you know me, I like that stuff. Hmm. So I was totally in.
Okay. Ben, you had some really strong feelings about this episode. What were they?
Well, I am just going to let our... There.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We go. Pop, we good? Good to go.
Yes, I believe so.
All right. My feelings on this episode were that I felt it had the strongest total of scenes thus far of the show. I thought, you know, there have been some great scenes so far throughout the five that we had seen, but in terms of just walking away from it feeling like the plot had been advanced and I got out of the characters what I wanted, this was like at least 65%. Unfortunately, and we will get to his character, I have like my final opinion on the Vince Vaughn storyline that's been waffling this whole time.
Okay.
When we get to his character.
You have a final opinion.
I'll share it when we get to it, but okay. In terms of the episode itself, I really enjoyed the episode. I thought it was well done, and I walked away from it very excited for the next one.
Me too. I really love this episode. I have to say, like we've talked much about the multi-director approach, obviously from the auteur, one director from season one. Justin Lin did a great job of setting the tone in the first two episodes. I feel like, you know, in terms of what we saw in after episode four, episode five for me, I felt a little lost. It felt a little different. It was very distinct. Look, each director sort of bring in their own style with the through line of what Nick Pizzolatto's done. But I really felt like episode five, I felt a little, it felt a little, you know, off brand for me. I was a little lost. This episode six, was... It felt like an entirely different show. I mean, an entirely different show. Not necessarily in a great, great way. Look, the whole of the show itself is fantastic. So we're here to nitpick this thing. We're here to like, take it apart. The show is fantastic. We all know we love the show. But I feel like what I saw from Miguel... Sapochnik. Thank you. From the get-go, it was fantastic, and a collection of wonderful scenes, including the one we'll start with, which is this sort of standoff with Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn, which we saw. I think Vince Vaughn had his coming out party there, because I think that a lot of us on the internet and some of us in this room have been trying to figure out Vince Vaughn's performance and if it's him, if it's this, if it's that. Do we like it? Do we buy him? Do we believe him? And I've been on record by saying I like it. But I'm all in now on Vince Vaughn's performance. What did you think of that scene, Ben?
Okay, so that was the most intense scene that we've gotten to witness between Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn this season, right? Every other scene, for the most part, has been this sort of like hazy fatigue in Colin Farrell's face, for the most part. Mm-hmm. He was a little sober in the one episode, but this was the most intense. The stakes were the highest. It was very engaging. It was like a much more serious scene version of that scene from Gross Point Blank.
Yeah.
But I walked away from that feeling like, okay, this was great. This is what I wanted to see. It was such a reminder to me that the stakes they're supposed to be high in so many of the scenes that Vince Vaughn is in, but they never seem to feel that way. This one felt that way, which is why I think that scene was so good.
I think it was, the relationship between these two characters, now that we've lived in them for six episodes, it all felt earned. So now I understand the relationship, we understand the history from all those one-on-one scenes we saw early in episodes one and two in the bar, all the way up into what we saw here. I felt every bit of the tension that was there. I thought it was well acted and well written and a wonderful scene. Flippo.
Yeah, I was just going to say my last point was that there was a couple lines that I thought Colin Farrell had in the scene that I really, really loved. I Sold My Soul for Nothing was one. Just there was a lot of emotion behind a couple of those lines that I enjoyed his delivery a lot. I thought it was one of his strongest scenes in the show so far.
He's good at acting.
He's good at it,
Colin Farrell kid.
Not bad.
Got a bright future.
He might have a future.
We'll see.
If he can get a good swing, you know, if he gets a shot. Somebody's got to give him a shot.
Yeah.
I thought that scene was great. You know, it was interesting because it really, you know, it's one of those scenes that really smacks of choice, because you could shoot that scene about 100 different ways given the dialogue. You could come busting in that door. He could come. It could be a screaming and yelling match in the kitchen. It could be too cool for school. It could be, you know, there's all these different options, but they chose to do it very, very still, very, very quiet, very, very simple. And just adding the guns worked. It made all that possible. And it was, to me, it was interesting that also that the next scene, or the two scenes later, you had Colin Farrell, after all the controlled he had to show all day long, with that first confrontation with Vince Vaughn, then with the visitation with his kid, then he goes and he has himself an enormous blow party.
Yes, which we'll get to.
He loses
his
goddamn mind. But it was that scene was terrific, and I think that, like you said, this is, you know, you call it Vince Vaughn's coming out party. I think that's fine, because I really bought the character. I enjoyed that. It didn't. Nothing screamed out at me as like, eh, you know. Mm-hmm. So really, really great work. And I love that his wife is off in the corner with her gun.
Oh, she was ready.
Which kind of, I'd forgotten that she was there. And it was oh, that's right. This was not going to go off one way or another. She was there too.
It was always
going
to get.
Yeah.
And she, well, Vince Vaughn said, me or my guys.
Right.
And I'm like, there's only one guy, but she's a girl. And she's in the back.
And she's all there.
And she's ready.
She's got to load it.
Joel?
I loved that scene. I feel like that scene sort of leveled the playing field of these two characters, and it showed that they have a true history together rather than just boss and employee. There's feelings toward each other that I feel that came out in that scene, and their history, and I feel like it also continued the stakes and heightened the stakes even higher, because the story didn't just stop there. You know, it's growing from there. So I really loved it.
Good. I love it too.
I love me some Vince Vaughn. We all know this.
I want to bring in John in this one, if you don't mind, John. I mean, obviously, I know that you're clearly a fan of the series. I know that you're going to watch all the time and you love it. Watching this for the first time put together, you know, what did you feel? What was your reaction?
I'm sorry, is the show started?
Yes.
I thought we were just recapping for ourselves.
No, we're rolling.
To me, I mean, since we're talking about Colin and Vince's scene in such detail, I think the biggest thing that I could say about it is that it is really good storytelling. Mm-hmm. Until that moment, there is no reason for them to have that face-off. And it follows such distinct and solid logic from Nick Pizzolatto, I'm talking about, that, I mean, sure, it's a fantastic payoff, but that it couldn't have happened before that moment.
Yeah.
For me, it really, really nailed it, and as far as what we were saying about Vince Vaughn, I mean, to me, it speaks to why I think his performance is just epic when it comes to nailing this guy, Frank Semien, because he can sit and talk to Ray Velcoro. He can talk to this cop, an ex-sheriff's deputy, who's basically coming from a rather low-rent background, just like Frank does, and they can talk to each other, and they know the streets, and they're savvy, and it's easy for them to communicate, which is true of Vince's character with just about everybody he talks to, until he talks to someone like my character.
Right.
And in that case, he's getting completely outclassed. Yeah. He does not have the sophistication yet that he wants to have to go legit, but when he can talk to a very corrupt cop, he can speak the language in a way and let himself go in a way that we don't otherwise get to see. And I, you know, so to me, I think Vince just totally nails the guy.
I mean, Frank is definitely more eloquent
he's philosophical.
Way, yes, exactly.
Yeah, he's been thinking a lot about, you know, where he is, where he comes from, where he wants to go.
Right.
And a lot of it really seems to come from a great place, because he loves his wife and he wants to build something for his family.
This brings up a question, which I want to ask you guys again. Is Frank a villain?
No.
You're saying no. John's like, no.
No. I don't think he is. I think he's a fairly glorious character in that he's making the best of what he was given. And he is trying to make this great leap into a new kind of life, for not just for himself. He wants to take the people that he cares about along.
Well, you know,
that makes him not a villain.
Well, the way this was kind of, you know, talked about in the casting earlier was like, when Vince Vaughn is the big bad, or Vince Vaughn is the is playing opposite, and it's the way we had it in our mind that, oh, Vince Vaughn's the bad guy. Mm-hmm. But you know, Nick Pizzolatto is smarter than that, and there is no real bad guy in that sense. Yeah. And there's some damaged people, some
corruption and fat cats.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there's some really, really bad people. Julie,
I've always felt that he is one of the most sympathetic characters in this show, even mm-hmm. though he does get gangster, even though he does pull people's teeth out, which mm-hmm. is kind of badass. Yeah. But he does say in this scene that he has a sense of justice, and I believe him wholeheartedly that he is guided by that sense of justice, and it comes out in so many different ways, and I think his performance has been pretty stellar in that regard, and it shows through.
Well, in that moment, so because you thought that, in that moment, did you think that did you think that Frank set him up? That, Frank, or did you think that Frank would never do that? He's got the sense of justice.
Well, he admits that, like, no, it didn't hurt to have you on my side to blackmail you. He's always trying to achieve this status, your character's kind of status. He wants to be in that circle, and he's willing to do what he needs to do to get there, which is not often legal. It is not often pretty. So he's not, like, a great guy.
Yeah.
But he does have an ethic and a set of morals that does guide him.
Right.
I kind of feel like if he had known that he was setting him up, he at the time that he did it, he would have taken every effort to find the real guy. I don't think he would have left that guy out there.
Right.
Because I think he's too smart for that.
That makes sense.
I think so, too. I think he wouldn't leave a loose end.
It was also 11 years ago, and he was in a much different place 11 years ago.
Crooked.
And a leather jacket on.
Yeah.
He was wearing those fresh suits. There's a lot. We learned a lot in this scene about not only about the two characters, but just about sort of like what potentially could be going on and who's on whose side. And I think that between what we saw in episode 5 with Frank and his wife, and what we saw in episode 6 with Frank has done a real character that already had a lot of depth and a lot of interesting notes. It turned into a real, like, deep, wonderful, full-bodied glass of wine. I really think I love the Frank Sinatra. I went from, like, I like Vince, I'm not sure what he's doing, but I love it, to, like, I love this character. Like, this is part of the thing we talked about this being an eight-hour movie.
Yeah.
And sort of having to sort of look. It's an eight-hour movie.
Yeah.
It's hard to go up after episode 1, like, I don't know about this one, or episode 3. But once we get there, now we're getting pretty close to it, and things are forming, and I'm looking back over the last 6 episodes, I'm like, yeah, that was a great performance. I really like Frank. So, I don't know. We'll see. I mean,
and it's okay for that to take time for us to get to that point before we learn enough about him that we can appreciate him at least.
Sure,
you know, appreciate his fully formed consciousness or something.
Sure,
you know, Pizzolatto's a big fan of Dennis Potter's work. If you know his, he wrote the original The Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven, The King from England.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go back and look at those and rewatch those as an 8-hour movie.
Right.
You know, I think what you said is exactly right. I think someday, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, we'll go back and revisit True Detective seasons as if the same way we revisit The Godfather's.
Yeah.
Sure.
Films and, you know, these classic movies that we categorize as movies, but television has finally kind of taken its place in that pantheon.
Sure. What do you call it? Post-secondary?
Post-secondary traumatic syndrome.
This is an argument he and I have had for years now. The post-secondary golden age of television, is that what we're calling it?
This is the post-golden age.
See, it's deep water.
Okay, there's the golden age. Everybody says
Sopranos the golden age. I think this is the golden age.
Oh, God. You can think all you want.
I love you, and that's all I can say.
It's fact. Okay, so let's continue with Frank, because then we'll get back to Volcaro and then the mission and everything. Let's continue with Frank, because there's one thing that he did say in the room that was very telling and interesting. When he's like, you know, when Ray asked them, "Are you going to be around?" He's like, "Look, being on the ropes is not the same as bleeding out."
Yeah, you know that.
That was very cool. It's the story of my life, Flippo. I'm like, yeah, you
don't
tell him.
Bleed on my floor.
But then we see. It's interesting the way the story's told, because we get to see Frank, who's kind of on his own detective mission, isn't he? Like, Frank is actually, you know, we predicted this early on, that Frank would become a detective of his own. And now his story has evolved into him, like, tracking some people down and tracking down the hard drive and tracking down the woman. And so doing your bidding, essentially, or maybe trying to make a friend with your character, John. So, I don't know. So moving on to Frank's next confrontation. The next thing we see Frank do?
He goes to visit Stan's widow,
family.
And then he also goes to the Mexican standoff.
Right. So let's talk about
actual Mexican.
Which is a funny line. That's a great line. Yeah.
What did you think about the visit and the way that played out?
I hated it.
You hated everything.
I hated it.
Well, I know what I hated about it, but I hated the outside. I hated the fact that
the
Vince
kid
makeup,
and he's hugging the kid and the heavy handedness. I did like that it was juxtaposed against the scene with Colin Farrell and his kid at the same time. And those were the cuts. Because we've talked about the overarching theme of parenting and especially fatherhood in this show.
Yep.
So that's interesting to me. My biggest issue with, and this is what I won't go on a rant here because we've talked a lot about it already, but my big issue with Vince Vaughn's character on this show, I thought that it was that character didn't fit in the narrative of the story as much as, that was my initial thought, right? Mm-hmm. Too much real estate for this one character that wasn't as compelling as the other three. I don't think it's that as much now as that I don't think Vince Vaughn's doing a bad job. I just don't think he was the right actor. And it's funny because it was written for him. I don't think that he's the right actor because most of the scenes he's in, I find myself watching and going, I know what you're doing. You're not ruining the scene by doing a bad job. I like Vince Vaughn a lot. I want to see somebody where I just, in their eyes or something, I just feel... I want it to feel different when I'm watching those scenes. I don't feel compelled by his character, and it's difficult that it's six episodes in. I agree he had a coming out party, and I liked his character in this episode far more. But at this point, I'm five episodes deep, and I don't find him to be engaging or compelling as a character. So it's hard for me now, just because he had a great scene, to jump on and say, well, now I care about this scene, I care about his... Like, I just wanted to go back to the other characters, which is why the scene with Colin Farrell to me was great, because it's putting him with the strongest character in the show.
Fair enough. Jules, what did you think of that scene?
Wasn't my favorite scene, wasn't my least favorite scene. I don't necessarily think it was the most necessary scene, but I thought his speech to the kid was, I thought that was compelling. I was moved by it, considering what his history is, not only his childhood history, his history with his father, his inability to have children at the moment.
Therefore, making it necessary. It's a necessary, I think it's a necessary scene to get to the bottom of
it. But I feel like I already knew it. Okay. I think. But I think it was, I thought his performance was lovely and moving, but I don't know if it would have been as moving had that juxtaposition not been there with Colin Farrell and with Ray Valcora and his son, Chad. Right. But, you know, I could take it or leave it.
There's also the whole issue of Stan being this character that we're supposed to understand who he is, and he shows up for, like, a scene in the first episode.
Well, I think that the action of the scene is not just to demonstrate the juxtaposition between the different kind, you know, parenting, not parenting, father figure for a brief moment, not father figure for a brief moment. I think it's also to show the boss caring for his people.
Sure.
And that's there to give us a little more insight into Frank, I think, to show us that this is not just, that Stan dying was not a casual thing for him. And you know, when he's taking himself legit, he's taking his crew legit also. And so, you know, and that also plays into why he's having so much trouble with the other guy who's stepping out and created this whole side thing with the Russians and the girls and the whole thing, because he thought he was taking all of his guys in this one direction. And what did he say about, you know, his wife said Stan wasn't running things for you. And what do you call it? Skill sets, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the I think the action of the scene is to show that these people were his family. They meant more to him than just, you know, foot soldiers, because he's not really that gangster, if he ever was. He's not that anymore, or trying not to be that. And I thought it was also interesting the way that Jordan kind of played in, because, you know, there's that thought that she's kind of along for the ride a little bit. At least that's kind of where I've been putting my head. But this episode, that's no longer the case. I mean, she's standing off to the side with her little, was it 38 special? Is that what she had in her
hand? Looked like it, something like
little,
that.
Yeah. Something, it was dainty. You know, in the scene with Colin Farrell.
Makes a damn big hole, though.
It does. Yeah. And it depends what you load on. It might be a little back out, too. But she was there with the money too, and the way she handled the money was great. This is not we're not buying. This was his money.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't feel bad about taking this. I thought that scene was great. It established them as a couple too. They're in this together.
Yeah.
In a way, I think previously I hadn't felt that they were. I felt very much like she wanted one thing, and he's doing his best to kind of bridge the gap between real life and what she wanted. In this episode, I felt like they really were together.
I disagree with that. I have been on board with their relationship since their very first scene together.
Me too.
I've always thought it was genuine and true, and this scene definitely solidified that she plays the perfect first lady.
Mm-hmm. I don't mean to say that she wasn't in and he wasn't in. I meant to say that this is her, I guess I would say, in the trenches, like she was in that cocktail party in the beginning. This is her working with him, which I hadn't seen in this capacity. I only seen her working with him in the attempts for the new
life. That's really because he's been keeping her out of it.
Yeah, okay.
You know, he has been kind of, you know, saying, please let me, I have to go do something you don't want to be a part of.
But I always felt like they were on the same page.
Yeah.
I never thought I that she was like, what, I want this, and he's trying to do it for her. I always felt like it's something that they dreamt together and are doing together and are complete partners in it.
All right. Well, maybe it just felt more solid to me then.
Okay.
Maybe they dragged me along.
Okay.
I will say I do agree with you, Jules. I think that I felt this all the way along, and I do agree with you, Joe. It's I think it's a good way to sort of establish some Vince Vaughn's character cares about stuff as opposed to being just a bad guy.
I think that
it also helped with all the conversations about them having a kid and adopting a kid and adopting a son, and you know, obviously the young son is sort of maybe Vince is looking at himself, Vince Vaughn, and giving him the love that his father never gave him. All that good stuff. We saw that in the scene. Then we go from there to see Vince go over to find the girl in the Mexican standoff scene. Like when he finds the girl,
Arena.
Yeah. And the poor girl's throat's cut.
Right.
Like, he was visually distraught.
Yeah.
And so it's, and he was really, and he said to the guy, like, why did you guys do that? Why did you do that? And again, more sympathy for Frank. Frank's just a guy who's just trying to
figure it out,
the shit in the horse, and figure it all out. He's not a guy who's just taking guys out and murdering people. And I thought it was a very, very sympathetic Frank episode.
It was nice to see. I mean, it was nice that he got played because he's been so like quietly blustery this whole show.
Yeah.
Every scene seemingly is him trying to flex.
Yes.
So for him to make a tactical decision like that, offer the cut, and then just get played like that, and you just see him weak. He's just, I'm not going to raise up on these guys. That was nice. It gave depth.
The other thing was, it really shows that he doesn't have the stomach for this anymore.
Right.
That the Mexican guys came to play, and he didn't.
Yeah, those guys are messing around.
You know, and he said, and it was great. It was very telling. He's sitting on that couch in that crappy little house, and they're just staring at him. He didn't say anything. And he made the deal. He made his own deal backwards. He said, I'll give you 3 days with no cut. And and a 5-year warranty, and I'll wash the car, and I got a service plan. I mean, he took the sales pitch out all the way. They didn't have to say a word. And then when he gets there and the girl's got a throat cut, to me, this is not a guy who can live in this world anymore.
Right?
You know what I mean? If he ever was,
he's now stuck in the middle.
Yes,
he's like in this purgatory of ex gangster and wannabe.
And it's not
legitimate
just,
business.
And it's not just a matter of circumstance any longer. That scene shows it's a matter of his stomach. He cannot do this.
Hmm. You know,
does that make any sense?
Absolutely.
Nor is
and
he ready
funny,
for what those people up there
that's
are
it. That's what
to
I was
do.
Going to say. And when he
that's
goes
why he's
real
being
money,
outclassed here, but go. Being outsmarted here.
That's right. It.
I want to shift over to... Go ahead.
What's just real fast on that note, what's funny is that in that very first scene with Ray, he says, you're free. You haven't had the nerve for this for a long time. And I'm wondering if that's partially him, partially Ray... I don't know. Sort of like a little comparison there.
Yeah, sort of speaking his own feelings.
That
could be true.
Like, it ain't pretty, guys.
Right.
He understands it ain't pretty, but if he wants to be there, he has to play the game, it looks like.
So speaking of Ray, let's talk about Ray, because he also had an interesting, some interesting things happen to him.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that Ray. Guy? Shaved his mustache.
Yeah.
No. That's what happened. No,
that's a big deal.
So we saw that deal. We talked about the him and Vince Vaughn scene, the scene with Frank, which was fantastic. But in the aftermath of that scene, we get to see him have a confrontation with the real rapist, which I thought was another riveting, fantastic scene. Which was sort of like the rage that was in his eyes and the rage that he felt that whole time, and the guy. Who was just a guy? Clearly, he's just a guy who, who may or may not have some mental problems, may or may not remember it, and all of that rage and hatred and vengeance that he wanted to wreak upon someone. Like, this guy is not the guy to do it. It's kind of a weird scene. It's a very empty, but it was closure for him, but it was very empty as well.
I can tell you, I'll never look at a cheese grater the same.
Yeah,
that's a tough. That's a tough way to go.
That's a lot. He said a lot. I think it's
it was very specific too.
That was the problem.
Never be around a cheese grater that had your pants on.
Colin had some real images going on in his head, and we felt them.
Logistically speaking, a cheese grater's got to be a pain in the ass for that kind of thing. You gotta clean it all the time. It can't be. And if you try cleaning a cheese grater, just chew a sponge to pieces. I'm just saying.
Thank you, Flippa.
Just saying, you got to think these things.
Welcome back to the panel, Flippa.
Thank you. You were saying that.
So I had this thought when I was watching Velcora this episode where. where I made a note here. I wrote, he's all, I want to find here. So he's like all lazy intensity. Like his bluster is derailed by his crippling and stifling self hatred. It's just it's just sedates everything that he does.
You wrote that down there?
Well, that's good. I wrote it when I was, because my thought
like
was,
Nick wrote that.
It's like when you're watching a character like that who says, and he's looking through the window and he's saying all these really intense things, and he walks away with this cheesy line. He says, "I don't even know you, man." And he says, "You know me, you just didn't know you did." Yeah. And you're like, it's the way that he treats all of it. You're like, I understand the way you feel about yourself, and you're this really intense guy, and maybe you could be a crack detective if you just kept it together. But you don't, and you hate yourself, and you're an alcoholic, and you're just that. You're like a bully the way you're even talking to that guy. You're never going to do any of that. Yeah. You'll get drunk, and you won't do it instead. Like, it was just like, it's amazing to watch a character that's so intense that you just sort of know that character's intensity is completely derailed by them just having a total limp.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, the way he described...
Demons. Yeah, there's demons, exactly.
The way he described the way he was going to torture this man is so opposite from what he actually did to the fake rapist that he did kill. He said, "I'd never even asked him any questions."
Right.
Whereas now where it's totally safe, it's behind glass, the guy's already behind bars, he can really just like draw it out and say, "This is what I would do, this is what I would do," but when push comes to shove, it's probably just going
to
shoot him.
And that's some catharsis there. There's some very cathartic about being able to say that stuff out loud.
But he's definitely fueled by rage rather than revenge.
Right. I agree.
Well, because there's that line that Ray has, right? He says, "Your crooked rage was always there. Didn't it just help you become the man that you always were going to become?"
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Sure. That's good stuff.
I could have been different.
So then we see him with his son, which I thought was very, very good. Go ahead, Joe.
Who is this kid's dad? Who do we think the dad is?
It still doesn't look like that rapist.
Yeah, it doesn't look like him.
I mean, not even a little bit.
I don't know.
I feel very uncomfortable. That scene made me feel so uncomfortable because what they're doing with the kid is I don't like feeling this way about a kid. But I mean, it's obvious. Like, we're sitting there, we don't want to build a model. We just want to sit and eat pizza and watch TV. And just
a 20-year-old show.
Funny
20-year-old show.
It was a weird. What are we supposed to feel about this kid?
Well, I feel like the kid is like that. That's kind of very true-ish to like sort of the kids of that age. Like, they're not all like these precocious bowl cut kids you see on TV. Like, "Hey, pops, let's blah blah blah."
No, but I mean, I think that like,
but what is just a normal kid is just like, "Oh no, let's watch TV." I mean, that's kind of like, I don't know. I don't know. That felt pretty real to me.
There are no accidents in Pizzolatto's show. I mean, I don't think there's anything by accident. So I don't know. What do you think we're supposed to feel about this kid?
Go ahead. I just think he's a normal kid. I think he's a kid. I think a kid who's in the middle of some stuff. His parents are going through this crap. His dad's here. He doesn't know what to think about his dad. He even his kind of like apathy. Like, kids don't, I don't know, kids don't really emote at that age like that. They're not going to have to come up with some really flowery line about like, "Dad, I really miss you, and I want you to know that every time I saw the cube." Like, he's just like, "How do you feel about that if I don't see you?" He's like, "I don't know."
The scenes were juxtaposed. It was, so you had not just Frank juxtaposed with Ray as far as the little fathery moment. You also had the kids juxtaposed. You had one kid outside playing ball, and young kid, skinny, sleek, athlete kid. And then you had the other kid watching TV, eating pizza. This is not an accident. So I mean, like,
John, what do you?
I think that, you know, you had mentioned earlier this kind of one of the themes being about parenthood, specifically fatherhood. I think the purpose of juxtaposing them that way was one to show that Vince has the capability to impart the role of a parent and do it in the right way. Where Colin's character, where Ray Velcoro realizes that he's utterly inept at it, no matter whose kid it really is. I personally think that kid has a suspicion, or at least he'll grow up to go, "That's not my father." You know, it's almost irrelevant who the father is, and it could be that Abigail Spencer's character was having affairs on him while they were married, which I think is
I think it's pretty possible
because Ray's been a basket case for a long time.
Yeah.
You go back to the Fred Ward scene
when he met
his father, you know. But I think, you know, I mean, one, maybe Vince's character doesn't have an epiphany about it. He just, it comes naturally to him to be able to talk to a child and let him know that you're going to experience these things in life, and what you do with them is up to you.
Okay.
Sorry, it's my wife.
That's all right.
I'll get to that in a minute.
As long as you and not one of us.
Hi, honey. Hi, honey. I think she's watching. but Velcoro has his own epiphany that's not very positive for him, where I think he realizes it doesn't matter whose kid it is. I know I love him, but I'm nothing but trouble for him. I cannot be a father.
Yeah. Well, and they're trying to create this the ultimate tragedy in Velcora's situation from the first episode, where his kid is he's overweight and he's literally like the redheaded stepchild.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he gets beat up for his shoes. He wants to watch Friends. He's a sissy. They're trying to do all these things where you're like,
I like Friends.
I love Friends. I just mean the way that he interacts.
Give me
and
your shoes.
He seems so scared. And they're trying to set it up so that it's like Frank, you know, or not Frank, that Velcoro is holding on to this thing that ultimately you're watching and you're like, you are struggling. You're even struggling to want to love this kid, but you know you are supposed to, and you're telling yourself to love him.
That's what I think is...
I think that's part of it, but you know, with all these characters trying to achieve some sort of redemption in their life, I think he's grasped this thing and held on to it desperately because that's the one redemptive thing he has.
If I
can be a father to this kid.
Yeah. There's also...
And he finally realizes, I can't. That's when he goes off the rails.
Yeah. It makes you wonder if there's like a pizza-eating, friends-watching, comic book store owning, big, huge, red-haired dude out there kind of going, I wonder if I have a son somewhere.
And I passed a joint right down the
street. I want to move on. I don't want to get short on time here, but I want to just get to Ray's way of coping with his grief and his you know, he goes home and he gets the bottle of tequila and he gets a bag of some powdery white substance.
I've never done coke, but that looked like a lot of coke.
That was a lot. That was like for a party. like a bunch of people.
Like,
is that how it works?
A little much.
Does his heart explode now? Is that how it works? I'm like, he's gonna die. How sad.
I thought that was a great scene. That Colin Farrell, did a great scene, just a job of sort of, you know, letting us feel his pain. There was no moment in that whole scene when you're like, yeah, buddy, get it, woo.
Although with all the bolo ties he wears, I did not take him for a punk rock kind of guy.
No,
that
true.
Surprised me.
No, he's disco all the way.
and then his very defeatist sort of call, you know, desperate call to the wife, and that was, you know, also very, very sad, but it's very, like, it was super, showed his love for his son, in my opinion. Like, you know, if you love something,
just let it go.
If you love somebody, let him free.
Set
exactly.
it free.
If it doesn't come back, hunt it down and kill it.
It's funny because I felt like that scene was, I felt like that scene was cartoonish, but not actually in a bad way. It was a very effective scene,
right.
And I really enjoyed the second half of it after the weightlifting and the punching.
Yes.
When he's just sitting there, sliding off the couch, crying. And then the best part was when he's just sitting there quietly, the final shot before he makes the phone call, and it's all done. It's like if you've ever just stayed up all night drinking, and everybody leaves, and the sun comes out, and you just sit there and you feel so sad and drained.
Yep.
You're like, it's over. And I felt like that was just the penultimate version of that.
Yep.
So even though it did feel a bit cartoonish, like just the punk rock and all of it, I thought it worked really well. It was very effective.
He played it so beautifully.
And very much enjoyed that they didn't show him destroy the room. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
That would have been indulgent and necessary. I like that they did it Greek. Like, come out, the tragedy's over, let me tell you about it.
Right.
I like that.
So what are we to make of Velcoro, of this new Ray Velcoro? Because I think that, like, we've seen all these different versions of him. We first meet him, he's a complete burnout, like, drinks too much, smokes too much, does a little too much everything else. Then a completely broken man. And then he sobers up and sort of, you know, gets himself together, quits the force. He's still under Frank. He's now free from Frank, theoretically. He's free from his son. He had one last go-around with the booze and the coke. Is he back to burnout? Is he a brand new guy? Like, what is this new? What do we expect from Frank?
I think the clue is in what Frank told him earlier in the episode, all that rage, you know, made you what you are. Mm-hmm. And now he is free of all those things. So, yeah, I think we're going to see the real Ray Velcoro now.
Yeah, I agree. I think that he's not going... I think he's going to cease trying to be what other people want him to be and just let it go.
Just go
with his gut and what he feels. And
for the record, I don't know. I really don't know what happens.
Yeah, I was going to ask about how much you do know, because I'm wondering, are we going to find out who the father of Ray's son is? Are we going to find out? Do we? I mean, is it? I wonder if we'll
or is
know.
It just done?
Is it done?
Just done.
It could be. It could be. Let's move on. Just really quick to Rachel McAdams going undercover. She's working out. Her sister knocks on the door. She's doing a little bit of a workout. I found that very disturbing, that workout, especially her finishing move.
The knife workout?
Yeah.
And yeah.
I'm like, come on! I'm like, enough already. He's already
I felt
dead.
That one sitting in my living room.
I'm like, no! I'm like, dude's dead already. But, the finishing move. And, props for Rachel McAdams. She's really good.
Yeah. That was awesome.
I did not want to meet,
I loved it.
Yes. So,
I want the behind the scenes video with the trainer standing there with her. And she's got her hair in a ponytail, and it's clear, like the actress thing. She's got like Lululemon pants on. She's working on her knife moves, her like months of prep for the show. That's the video I want to see.
Well, she nailed the finishing move a little too strongly there. So I feel like she's got it.
She killed it. She's amazing.
But what do we, that relationship between her and her sister, I think is really interesting. And I think that we're learning more about her characters. Again, we learn more about the characters through their interactions with others. And so, again, we're learning more about Rachel McAdams, about Annie Vizzaretti's more as we see her interact with the world. And I think that her the way she interacts with her sister kind of tells us more about sort of like what their relationship continues to be. But there's still some tenderness there,
A little bit.
I think she always has a soft spot for since the very first episode.
Right.
That is her soft spot, is her sister.
Right.
That's the only thing that she holds on to.
Right. So this is where it gets kind of weird for me. And I'm on board 1,000%. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But so they go to undercover to this party. She gets undercover. She gets to
this corporate orgy, if you will.
Like that she is $2,000 a night. Was that the party?
Yeah.
She can't wear anything. They got the tracker. She put a tracker in her shoe. None of that seemed very safe to me.
No, not at all. Why are they letting her do that?
Yes.
What I want to know is, where are these Eyes Wide Shut parties? Nobody tells me anything.
I know. I never get invited.
I'd go to the party.
I mean,
These things, they must happen because we see them on the TV. Weekend.
Yeah, they must be real.
They must be a thing.
I don't know. But
John, did you get to go?
No!
Damn it!
We were hired, all the speaking actors except for Rachel, we were hired for 3 days for that shoot, which was in a big mansion over in Pasadena. But they only worked us the first day.
Oh wow!
So Tim Murphy, a guy who plays the Russian Osip, and I, we shot our scene about 1 o'clock in the morning, and Miguel, who directed the episode, was running back and forth between three different setups, which was Rachel walking through the room, and Tim and I in the office, and Colin beating the shit out of somebody outside. So there were three camera setups, and Miguel. Wow. Is running back and forth and directing all of them at the same time at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, wow.
Wow, talk about consolidation.
Yes.
That's efficient.
He's got a big brain, that Miguel guy.
Your scene that you're talking about with Osip, it was funny to me because it was the most like, it was like over here is like corporate deal. Money, signed contracts, something nefarious. And you're like, yes. And he's like you cheated him? He's like, not quite. And then you're like, of course. You're like, something bad's happening. Like, it was like one of those things where like, I feel like I know so little really about what's going on, but I tried to make sense of the pieces. Like, I think I get what's going on here, right? But I think it's the paintbrush of like, what am I looking for? Like generic sort of contracts and like espionage
but
and all that.
Again, the clues are there though. Every bit of dialogue is a clue.
Right.
Almost every shot.
I don't doubt every line in the scene. Right? It has to be written down and referenced next week.
What I really dig about it is that we do learn it as the viewer learns it. As the characters learn.
You as actors.
We actors learned it as everybody was learning it.
It was fantastic.
Secrecy was crazy.
I can't even imagine.
So just
finish up. Like, so Annie gets into the party. They give her a little dose of some Molly, pure, and I read about this Molly. I'm not too familiar with it.
I've never tried the Molly.
But
it's ecstasy, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
That's roughly. It's
the same thing. MDMA.
It's the same thing.
MDMA, which is ecstasy.
Oh, except I'm no expert on this ecstasy stuff. But I don't know. In the experiences that I've read about or heard about from others.
So I'm told.
So I'm told.
I remember the book. You lent it to me.
I don't know that her rolling was a little
different than what I read in the book.
Different than what I read in the book.
Yeah,
she was
because when I read the book, it was a little more clarity.
When
than
I read
that.
The book, I don't remember any hallucinations or any kind of weirdness or anything like that.
I have a friend that read the same book.
Yeah,
and we were watching the episode.
Wait a minute, is this guy friend of everybody?
And he looked.
He gets around, man.
My buddy looked. He looked over at me when it was happening. He's like, "It's kind of shameful that they're presenting a Molly trip like this." He's like, "This is ridiculous." As you just feel really happy. That's it.
That's what I said when I read the book.
That's what the book said to me.
That's what the book said.
That's what the book said.
I haven't read the book yet, but I've
read
other
books.
Well, if
the book
says so, other books that I've read.
Yes.
It really depends on your environment, does
it
not?
That's very true. It does depend on your environment.
I think you're right.
That's the book I read.
No, you're absolutely right. And from what I read, it depends on your environment.
And I've read it more than once, and it's been different every time.
Anyway, so she had a bad experience with the Molly. She tries to puke some up, but I don't know. She was good.
Did you feel like, okay, you're a cop, and you arrest people for doing drugs, and you're not, like, 55. You're, like,
yes.
32 or something. Like,
yeah.
Why are you making yourself puke when you put something, an injectable, like, in your bloodstream? Like, what are you doing? I just felt like that was so stupid. I was like, really? Well, you're a cop, and you're going to try to make yourself...
She's desperate.
Maybe it's her first time reading the book. I don't know.
You just didn't feel like she would know.
Read the
don't
book.
You have to know how that stuff works if you're a police officer?
But she gets in there. She seems
to
okay.
Read that book.
The Molly takes effect. She starts having some interesting flashbacks to what we presume is a...
it's her time on the commune, which I mean,
yes.
It was a pretty
back of the
obvious
commune.
Back of the commune.
I called that a long time ago.
The adults
were having sex with the babies.
Yes.
Something
the
weird.
Unicorns in the field, and that was all bad.
Yeah.
All bad. So
real creepy.
So now we know where it's coming from. I mean, the Molly induced that, so that was good that we found that out. But then she finds... what's my girl's
Vera.
Name? Vera.
Yeah.
And, and we knew at some point the knife would come out and she was going to gut someone. We called that from episode one.
That was great, wasn't it?
And then he's standing there and you see
even
the blood pooling.
And what, is it, what did he say?
Fuck
what
you
the
do.
What you do to me.
What you do.
What you do.
What
you do.
Yeah.
That was badass.
And it was very cool.
He bled out just in time for her to not,
And he puts his hand up and just smacks away.
Yeah,
it was very cool.
Did she stab the other guy,
too? Yeah, did she kill the old man?
She kicked him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
She popped him in the balls.
She did a little this action, and then something happened. He fell, and then I thought she kicked him.
I thought she got him too.
And
I thought, like, God, that was gratuitous because he's just a poor oral boy.
I don't think she.
All right,
she twisted his arm.
They have to leave something.
Yeah.
Coming to an eyes wide shut party in the middle of the night.
He didn't deserve that.
No, that was some strong Molly. It made her kill a dude. Might make her kill a dude, but she killed a guy.
She had to kill a dude,
right? No one's ever killed anyone in the books I've read.
No,
you didn't read the whole book.
I read the book a couple times.
Yeah.
I remember the book being very peaceful, very
peaceful, very nice. Anyway, so that whole scheme was great. I mean, look, what else? I mean, a lot of sex. A lot of violence.
Right.
A lot of stuff happening in the house. She got through. I think the guys outside that whole scene was very cool that they were there. And I mean, the plausibility factor, I'm not gonna touch it. I don't know.
I opened door and Paul Woodrow is standing outside the door.
I don't know.
That moment you're talking about?
But I loved it. Yeah, I thought it was all awesome.
I loved it. I feel like I've been waiting for it for this entire season. I was a little thrown off by the music.
Oh, really? I thought the music was excellent. See,
yeah, I'm with you. I loved it.
It's beautiful.
It just felt different in a completely different
way. It felt very different. And, the more I thought about it, I just watched it a second time. A little bit with you there, right there. And it felt very much so like a haunted house.
Yeah.
It felt like sort of horror film music to me. And I guess for this scene, it worked. It just didn't necessarily fit in... This True Detective world that they've built so far. It just took me out of it the first time I watched it. It completely took me out of it.
We watched it the second time together, and I kind of felt that way too. I felt like the music had a little too much going on.
Yeah.
If it pulled you out of the scene, it didn't.
Yeah.
It was trying to instruct you how to feel.
It was an interesting
much.
Choice, yeah. And it just didn't feel like it fit to me.
Hmm.
But to each their own.
And then juxtaposed against the Black Angels that play as they're leaving, right? Isn't that who that is? The rock and roll song that
is
plays?
Is it the Black Angels?
I think it's the Black Angels. Right. I think that's who that is.
Over the end credits?
Yeah. isn't it?
I think it is.
Yeah.
That was my breakdancing crew in
for Black Angels?
Yeah, in junior high.
I thought it still was.
It still is.
Really?
I would be Black surprised. Angels really? Broken wings and limp around. Cry a lot about their backs.
Making that up. Let's ask some people online. Oh, by the way, Sylvia Love says if we want to find those parties, we should check Craigslist.
Nice. Thank you, Sylvia. Thank you.
You know, once Frank Semyon achieves his goals, if he ever does, I think his guy Nails is going to fit right in with that crowd.
Oh yeah, we forgot to even mention.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah.
We forgot
nails
to even mention
with the nail gun.
The nails. Yeah. That was an ouch.
Yeah.
Got it. So John, I want to ask you just about your experiences on the show. I mean, first of all, can you tell us like anything? I mean, is there anything you can tell us about your character and shed any light to sort of like what we could expect? I mean, I know we know you've done.
To be honest, I really can't. I mean, we got our not only do we have a non-disclosure agreement, mm-hmm. but I just don't know because we got our scenes. Airtight. We got only our pages the night mm-hmm. before we worked. Electronically, we couldn't print them. We could.
Oh, really?
Seriously. Same thing with the audition. We got this. We had to sign an NDA
to start.
Online. Send it back. Then they sent you this audition material that wasn't even in the show.
Does your computer explode in 30
little
minutes?
Little puff of smoke comes out of the keyboard, just like Mission Impossible.
Everybody gets a new Mac, though. It's cool.
Yeah. It's a partying gift. Right? Yeah, bags of them at the wrap party. No, I really can't tell you. I think Jacob McCandless is a very, very manipulative guy, and he doesn't scare easy around somebody like Semyon, even though he knows who he is. He already knows he can out-fox the guy.
Mm. Right.
And that's exactly what he's doing. He's manipulating him. You see, it's like carrot and the stick thing.
Right. What's it like? We've read a lot about Vanity Fair profile. What's it like working with and for Nick Pizzolatto? I mean, is he
Nick
present?
Is great.
Is he present on the set all
every
the time?
Single every shot. Single shot. He was there. Okay. Night shots all the way till the sun was coming up. He was there every single day working with every director, every actor. My first day going back to my first dialogue day going back to episode 2 when we walked through the downtown oil rig.
Yeah.
And it's me and Vince and Vince's lawyer. And we spent all day long shooting that.
I love that scene, by the way.
Yeah, I did too. I thought it was a really cool scene.
That's a great scene.
At the end of the day, I'm walking to take my audio mic back or something, and I walk past Video Village, and Nick rips off his headphones and runs over to me and says, "John, that was great. You're doing such a great job.
Oh, wow.
Thank you so much."
Oh, that's nice. Great.
That's the kind of guy Nick is, Great. He'll give you a hug and say thanks, and he means it. And when he says, "I hope we work again," he means it. He's a very genuine guy.
Is there any like sort of on the fly rewrite because he's there? Is he sort of
crafting, he rewrites
rewriting
all the time.
On the fly?
Yeah, sort of like, absolutely. He'll be over there on his chair just working on just nitpicky little things. I see things change, in the edit from that scene I had last night was probably twice as long as what you actually saw, but they pared it down to just what was necessary.
Can I ask you this as an actor? Is it more nerve-wracking working with someone who's gotten so much attention for their writing and so much acclaim for their writing and having them right there, and is it nerve-wracking? Do you ever have moments where I better not move the I better not put the is? So
you stick very close to the text, but all I would say is, my first episode, I didn't really say anything. I just, had a toast with Vince Vaughn and stared at the back of Colin's head, But in the second episode, when I actually spoke and he had that kind of response to me, whatever intimidation I had, it went away.
Nice.
He went out of his way to make sure that you didn't feel intimidated around him.
Does he he's so poetic with his writing? It's so long winded in a lot of cases, and I mean the verbiage is very, very specific. When you speak with him and you've had any longer conversations, does he speak in the same way, or
no.
Is it just in his writing?
No, he's like, oh fuck that shit, come on, let's just go, come on, that's shoot cool. it already. John Crowley. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and Nick came over and said, "Why are we doing that shot again?" And John goes, "Well, the focus was a bit dodgy," and Nick goes, "Well, fuck the focus. It's 4 o'clock in the morning." He doesn't mean it.
So So you work. So you got a chance to work some. Yeah, you work with Justin Lin. You work
Justin
with
Lin did Jeff, the first two.
You work with Miguel
Sapochnik, who also did the Hard Home.
Hard Home, Game of Thrones, yeah. Episode 8. If you guys have not seen the Game of Thrones episode 8,
the big massive White Walker.
It is amazing.
Was that the oh?
He directed the episode you saw last night.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So you directed lots of episodes. And then John Crowley. So what's it, I mean, you know, again, we talked about before in film and in television, like you have different directors all the time. And usually it's like in last season it was one director. This time you work with Justin, you work with John, you work with Miguel. And with Nick there, what's that process like? Is it strange? Does it seem okay?
I found it to be very collaborative. The directors had free reign, but everybody knew what show they were making. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard some people say that, you know, maybe there's too many directors, but I really don't agree. I don't see a big change, mainly because the DP is the same guy.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point.
And he kept a consistent look all the way through it, and he's amazing. His name's Nigel Bluke, and he's fantastic. And Nick is the kind of guy, because the secrecy was so intense, he's the kind of guy who would walk over and tell you exactly why your character is here, what you're doing, how that relates to some things, but if it doesn't relate to something over here. And he'll even say, that has nothing to do with you. You just need to worry about this, this, this. So the architecture in his head and how he relates to everybody else was really valuable.
That's one thing I was wondering. Because there's so much going on. There's so many characters, so many things going on.
Very dense.
I wonder how much it's super dense. I wonder how much you as an actor has to be aware of the world that you're inside. Like there's so many other people populated in your world. Are you just concerned about you and Frank and your world, or do you know what's going on with Taylor Kitchen over here?
No, I didn't know about that, and there's no reason why I should.
Right.
Really. No. You know, even the character doesn't know that's going on necessarily.
Right.
But again, that's where Nick and the directors were just so great. They could just fill you into whatever questions you had.
Now, you're a director and producer yourself. Yeah. You have your own stuff you've worked on. Yeah. So working on something as high profile and really as specific as this, do you draw a lot of inspiration there creatively on your own stuff?
Man, it was like every episode you'd see me just kind of hanging around. You know, and all the other actors go back to their trailer. I'm going, you don't mind if I just stand in the back and watch for a while?
Sure.
You know, because I'd really like to see how you set this up.
Sure.
And I've never seen money thrown around at a production like that.
Yeah.
Even on the big budget studio films that I've been lucky enough to be in.
HBO, baby.
HBO, man.
They've got the cash.
They do.
Them and Netflix.
They got the nuka.
Yeah.
I was backtracking a little bit,
okay,
so we can move on.
Okay. So
backtrack all you want.
You started to touch on it a little bit, that you don't get your pages until the night before, that you're just getting bits of information thrown at you, what's important, what's impertinent. How difficult is it to build an entire character, your entire character of Jacob McCandless, when you only have these bits of information? Is there a lot in your head, in your imagination, that you've made up for his backstory?
Yeah, you know, you sit down and make up your own.
Because you're a powerful man.
And I did do that. I wrote a couple of paragraphs or a couple of pages of stuff that I just made up,
mm-hmm,
that I could take into the scenes with me. But, you know, it's important to remember if you're there, you know, basically to support the four big shots, because they're doing the real heavy lifting, those four actors are. You just have to be clear about what your character is there to be. You know, what cog in the wheel am I providing here? And once you're clear on that, then it's not that hard. It can be intimidating if you let it be intimidating.
Sure.
Yeah. As we talked about Vince Vaughn as the big bad, but I really think that you're the big bad. You're the guy.
Yeah.
Maybe.
You know?
That sounds like a prediction to me.
He's
the Yellow King.
Absolutely nothing about that.
You're the Yellow King. That's my prediction.
The Yellow King.
let's segue into predictions right now so we can get into some. Let's do some predictions. Boom.
Prediction number one.
There's a
done.
Drop.
There will not be.
There it is.
There it is.
I'll jump in because you took the first one.
Do it.
Last week, I had made a prediction that one of the main characters was going to die in episodes 6 through 8, and several of our fans, I think like a half dozen of them, tweeted at me and left comments about how obvious it was that Velcoro dies based on some of the stuff we saw in the dream sequence earlier and just the way that his arc is being set up. And I would say that I read into the stuff they said. I think that it was pretty correct. So I'm going to credit some of our fans as saying that Velcoro will die in one of the next two episodes. He's going to be the character.
Okay. All right.
All right, Jules?
My prediction was similar to his, that I do think that you have a lot more of your hands are way dirtier than we know already. And you are
McCandless
so desperate.
You're about.
McCandless.
Yes.
Yes.
Me?
Not John.
And your character is so desperate to get his hands on those tapes. I think we're going to find those tapes, and we're going to see some not-so-savory things that you were doing.
Maybe wearing some masks.
Maybe.
Flippo?
I think we're going to find out that Ray is not this kid's dad, and that his wife was having an affair, for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to be pertinent or not, but I think that that's definitely going to be the case. I want to say real quick, not a prediction, but the idea of a bad guy or good guy, I think in this particular season, just people following their own self-interest, which is always, to me, the best kind of television because, you know, evil for its own sake is so cheap and easy, but if you're just following your own self-interest all the way, then really good writing leads people to be, you know, to be in conflict, and bad versus good becomes kind of outdated, you know?
Sure.
So yeah, we still have the question that was stated.
You're right. Are you preparing yourself for Vegas this weekend, Joe? That doing that line.
If you're going to be in Vegas, we'll be there.
I want just a quick second here to give a shout out. A theory that was shared by one of our fans on Twitter as the local stigmatic. Mm-hmm. He wrote a few sentences about what he thinks is going on, and it was very elaborate. I know we all saw it on Twitter. I just wanted to read it out loud because I think it's pretty great.
Right.
Theory: Shasani's Lodge is a Bohemian Grove type of cult of the rich and powerful, meeting in the woods once a year to sacrifice women to a bird god. They saw a chance to cheat Frank and Casper out of $5 million and steal Casper's blackmail videos, and took it by torturing and killing him. Mayor Shasani is now using Vinci PD to clean up the murder, planting evidence on the Mexicans. The Birdman is Lieutenant Burris. He used rubber bullets, like cops use, and was awfully quick to Belcora's shooting scene. What are you doing with my scene, Lieutenant? Perhaps to give his fingerprints an excuse for being there. Notice he was opening cupboards without gloves on. That's a very specific choice for an actor or character. Shasani's lodge is deep in the woods, similar to the Bohemian Grove, in the tall trees where Belcora was murdered, as he and his dad prophesized in the Purgatory, when he and Bezzarides get too close to solving the murder. It was probably a little convoluted,
but it was so good.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. That guy should be a writer.
You should. I want to hear yours. I just want to say very quickly, my official prediction is that I think that your character is going to get away clean. I think he's going down.
Duh.
I think he's going down.
You think he's going to go?
He's going to get away with it.
Okay. Good.
Oh, okay.
I think that they will. You know, they'll have all the evidence and they'll take these guys down. But I think that Mr. Teflon here will skate. That's what I think.
Looks too good in a suit. He's not going to.
And I think, but I also believe that Frank hopefully will still rise, and Mr. Teflon will skate, and then we'll see.
Characters like yours always get away with stuff. Yes. In shows like that's Pizzolatto's whole thing.
That's his whole thing,
right? Like he wants the corporate guys to win.
That's the country we live in. It's beautiful.
Exactly. Don't get started.
John, can we get a picture from you? You know stuff. But what do you?
I predict that.
Network is uncomfortable.
None of us know what's going to happen.
There it is.
Well played, sir.
I predict you're not going to get it from me.
Thank you. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you very much. This is a great time.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks for doing your homework.
Yeah, you can see John. I mean, John, where can the kids find you on Twitter? It's at V. John Lindstrom. At V. John Lindstrom. So you can check him out on Twitter. Joe Flippo, where can they find you?
You can find me on the Twitter. It's at Joe Flippo, JoeFlippo.
Julia?
Twitter on Instagram with my name, Julia Carely, JuliaCarely.
You guys can find me at Ben Bateman Media. Ben Bateman Media on Twitter, Instagram, and occasionally Periscope, but probably not very often.
Yeah. And you can find me at Joe K. Braswell on Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope, especially from Vegas. Joe.
No,
I'm kidding. John, it's a pleasure having you, and we will see you all next week for the final two episodes.
Yep. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for coming, sir.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.